The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. I'm Charles Christian, and I'd like to thank you for joining me again for another of our shows. This week we continue our interview with the Reverend Bill MacDonald as we discuss his life and the lessons he has learned from his encounters with UFOs and alien abductions, multiple near-death experiences, the Vietnam War, meditation and mysticism. But first, there's nothing new under the sun, and that includes wacky conspiracy theories associated with pandemics. You'll be aware there's a widely held belief that the current coronavirus pandemic originated in a laboratory in China, but was then accidentally, or perhaps deliberately, released into the wild. But now, let's rewind the clock just over 100 years to the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 to 1919. Back then, there were suggestions that it was a form of bacteriological warfare unleashed on the world by Imperial Germany in a desperate attempt to stave off defeat, as it appeared it was about to lose World War I. The rumour was the Germans used their U-boat submarine fleet to spread the virus on a global basis. And, in another example of history repeating itself, just as today the 5G network and Bill Gates are being blamed for being behind the spread of coronavirus, so in 1918 there were people blaming the then still relatively novel wireless or radio telegraph systems and inventors like Marconi. There again, in 1918, dancing and jazz music were also being blamed for the spread of the pandemic, as were foreigners. Well, no change there then, and the last one, as even today foreigners are still being blamed for spreading the disease. Now, time for part two of our interview with the US Army Vietnam veteran, the Reverend Bill MacDonald. Bill is a chaplain, yoga meditation teacher, PTSD consultant, poet, motivational speaker, artist, and was awarded, among other things, the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, and the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. He founded the Spiritual Warrior Ministries, which provide free chaplain services for the military community across the US, and he's the author of numerous books, including his autobiography, A Spiritual Warrior's Journey. Here's the interview.
Guess I'm alive, right? I mean, I didn't know if I was dead or alive, because all I look down there and I see my heart with flames still shooting out of my vest, which is kind of a spooky thing, right? And I'm going, well, I guess I'm alive, right? And then I got blood on my hand from shrapnel or something. And so I go around, I open up the door to let the pilot out of my side. You have to slide back this armored plate that he has there to protect him. The pilots sit up there, they got armored plates, and they're sitting in an armored chair, and they got all this stuff. The door gunners are sitting back on a canvas chair with no doors or nothing, totally open, right? So, you know, who do they value, right? So anyway, so I get him out. Now my gunner's supposed to get out and do the same thing to the other guy on the other side, co-pilot. He ain't moving. So I go and open up the other door, and then I look at my door gunner slumped over his machine gun. And when I look up there, I didn't count him exactly at that moment. Later on, I counted him. But there were 17 exit holes coming out inside the helicopter. Now think about this for a minute. Guy shoots 18 rounds at me. One round explodes in my chest. There's no entry holes on my side of the helicopter, but on his side, there's 17 exit holes, and mm-hmm. He's got wounds on his back and everything else. And even weirder is there's this big transmission that sits in the middle there. Even if it went into my side, it should hit the transmission. How could it? go in, disappear, and come out the other side. It's like impossible. So I see him, and there's a pool of blood all on the floor and the seat, and everything is dripping. And he's looking at me, and so my adrenaline's going now. And so I pick him up, and I throw him on my shoulder. He was about 150 pounds, and, you know, not too much bigger than that. He wasn't really heavy, but about the same weight as me at the time. Now imagine carrying a guy 150 pounds running full sprint as far as you can to get away from the helicopter, right? And I'm running, and I feel it to my day. I mean, it was not good on the back. I don't advise it as an exercise. So a gunship finally came back a few minutes later, and the gunship is a smaller model Huey. It can only carry basically what they have. Mm-hmm. So they take the commanding officer, and they take this guy that's really wounded, and they leave me and this captain, this black captain was with me. And they look at me. Imagine this. You look at this helicopter. These guys are getting ready to take off, and they're waving at you saying, we got no more room. We'll send somebody back for you. And I'm looking where my helicopter's crashed, and there's 500 North Vietnamese just out there in the field. It's like a soccer field away. There they are, right? And then they go, well, we'll be back. I go, what? And they take off. And, they go, and I'm going, oh, okay. So when I went to the helicopter, I took my M60 machine gun off the pod, and I strapped 2,000 rounds of ammo, you know, into it with a, and I had a can of sea rations with grease on it, and I had that on the edge of it, so my ammo would just flow over nice and easy. I mean, I had it set up so it was just clean. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but ammunition comes for a machine gun or for an automatic weapon. Every fifth round is a tracer. Mm-hmm. If you have all tracers, you'll overheat the gun and all that kind of stuff. Plus, the one tracer every fifth round, you could aim. It's good enough. So never fired a machine gun on the ground before other than in a tower practice. So in anger and combat, I never fired a machine gun. Otherwise, I would have known you don't just fire off 2,000 rounds without stopping, right? I mean, things are going to happen, right? So I go out there. I got this thing on my shoulder, and I walk across the field because I've seen John Wayne movie. I've seen John Wayne do it, you know? I mean, in the movie, he had it on his hip, right? And he's firing this machine gun against the Japanese on Okinawa or someplace, right? And so I'm going, doing the same thing, right? I got the thing, and I got it on my hip, fire 750 rounds a minute. And I'm firing solid tracers coming out. So they're looking at it thinking, every fifth round, what's this guy got? Some kind of minigun? I mean, it's solid coming out, right? So they're thinking there's thousands of rounds coming at them. And so the North Vietnamese, ain't nobody advancing. They think I'm some kind of crazy guy out there. I think I scared them. I mean, I don't know if they want to be inside my body because I was adrenaline kicking, right? So I'm shooting at these guys, and I'm killing trees. I'm sorry. I've killed a lot of trees. Birds are flying. Monkeys are jumping. I mean, it just, and then all of a sudden, my pilot guy that stayed with me, I said, just cover my back. And he's got a .45 out. And he's standing behind me. You know, like, okay. and all of a sudden this gun makes a funny sound, just goes kind of click. And I looked down and the barrel was white hot, not red hot, white hot. It was just glowing, and it just bent. I couldn't believe that you could bend the steel barrel of a gun firing rounds. I never knew that. I mean, there's an infantry guy tells me that later on when I told that story, he says, yeah, we get out, we pee on it. We do our canteens on it. We do all kinds of stuff. Plus, we only fire five rounds and we stop. And then we fire five rounds and we stop. And that's only one tracer per five rounds. I go, oh, so solid tracers and not stopping. Anyway, so the gun was totally not workable. And in that case, you got two choices. You could surrender, and I didn't have to know the word surrender. I go, Kimosabi, you know, like long range. So, and I didn't know. And I'm going, I'd wave a white flag, but I mean, the Army in its infinite wisdom, right? It issues all your underwear, T-shirt, and hankies, and every part of your body that's a material is green. They don't give you anything white to wave, right? You can't give up. So it's like, and they don't teach you the word I surrender. So anyway, at that point, I figured I'd make a strategical move. And what we call escape and evade the rest of the day. So it was like 8 hours later before they come pick us up, which I was surprised that they didn't come after us. But my feeling was they're waiting for somebody to come pick us up. And by the time they got there, they've already taken care of the Army. Already took care of those guys. But that was a long day. So we get back. They take a look at the helicopter, And that's when they count the eight, the round in my chest, and then 17 rounds on the other side. And nobody could explain it. All right, now let's go fast forward a couple minutes. 6, 7, 8 years ago, whatever it was. I get a call from Langley, Virginia. I don't know if in England you know where that's at, but that's like 10 Downing Street for politics. Langley, Virginia is like, that's the home camp for the CIA. That's where they live, right?
Yeah.
So I get a thing on my phone saying Langley, Virginia. I'm going, who the hell Langley, Virginia? So I call it up. The guy goes, is this William McDonald, serial number, blah, blah, blah. And I go, got my old Army serial number, right? And I go, who is this? He says, that's not important. But yeah, it is. I'm talking to you. He says, well, we're a contractor for a government agency. Oh, you mean like CIA? And he doesn't say nothing, right? He goes, he says, well, I got your file here, and I'm reading up, and he's reading up on all these different instances of me in Vietnam predicting stuff and doing things like that. And I said, what do you mean you got my file? He says, I got a file here. He says, well, can you send me a copy? He says, if I do, I have to redact everything but your name. You're not entitled to know, you know, what we know about you. I said, what's in there? He says, what you told us. I said, I'm not entitled to read what I said. It's classified. How can it be classified? I know what I said. Right? So I have this argument with the guy. And the guy goes, we want to know how you did this. How did you bend those bullets so they didn't go in you? How'd you know this? And I said, well, I said, if you want to fly me in and wine and dine me, I'll come to Langley, you know. But I said, you're going to be disappointed. I said, that's just decades and decades of meditation and whatever inner abilities I have. I said, I can't teach you how to engineer. They wanted to engineer with electronics. I said, I can't teach you to do that. He said, well, we got a $28 million budget to start with on this project. And I go, what? So I started asking him some questions, and he basically tells me, he says, I said, am I the only one? He says, oh, no, there's a whole group of you guys. He says, we call you guys the Jedi. He says, that's not the code name. That's not the code name. He goes, that's not the code name. Please, that's not the code name. We just call you Jedi. I said, oh, okay. So apparently the remote viewers that they had at Stanford Research with the remote viewing guys, that was later after I got out of the Army. But apparently they were watching military people that had any unusual experiences and talents, and they were recruiting them at the time. I didn't know that. So I'm in Nam, and I had these visions when I was a kid. I had a near-death experience when I was 8 years old. I was in a hospital. And in this vision that I had, this near-death experience, it showed things in the future. One of the things I saw was me sitting in this helicopter, having no idea at 8 years old that it was the Vietnam War, having no idea it's a Huey helicopter, having no idea any of that, right? But I see myself in this flying helicopter and facing this exact situation I came to. I had a new pilot come in from Germany, graduate of West Point, and by the book, I mean, picture by the book, British military officer, you know, with that attitude, you know, it's, you know, just like he would have fit well, he would have felt really well with the British Army in the old days, right? He was by the books. Okay, with your red coats, line up, you know, it was all by the book. We don't want to listen to these troops, you know, they don't know nothing. I went to the academy, right? So he comes in after doing this duty, all his duty in Germany and the Pentagon or wherever, his first combat assignment, and he's flying. And he goes out there, and there's only two officers. There's him and another officer, pilot, and there's two crew members. There's only four people on a helicopter. I said, you don't salute on a helicopter. You don't say, yes, sir. It's an informal thing. Everybody's just a friend and a buddy, right? You don't pull rank on four guys, right? Come on. So, and I kind of tried to tell him that, and it didn't get very well, and he let me know he's in charge. I said, okay, great. So we're flying around, and in Vietnam, the safest place to fly would be what they call the nap of the earth. In other words, you take the helicopter, and you zoom down, and you're only feet from the grass, right? Mm-hmm. Or feet from the top of the trees. You're just as close as you can go, and you fly down the rivers just over the water. And the idea behind that, besides having fun, be honest with you, it was fun for the crew. I got a motorcycle. But it's safer because the enemy doesn't see you coming until you're right there. You're just coming over the trees, and there you are. They might hear it. They don't know where you're at. They don't. But if you're hanging up several hundred feet in the sky, they can see you, and they can hit you. So I'm trying to explain that to this guy. but he wants to fly at an altitude where he can, because he's never been there, he doesn't know where he's going. He's trying to navigate visually off his, because you know your maps of the region, there's nothing to map out. It's like here's a river and then you got jungle and you got aviation maps don't show you nothing. There's nothing on an aviation map, right? And he's trying to figure this thing out, and he goes, so he's trying to watch for landmarks, mountains, rivers. And I'm trying to tell him this is dangerous. Then pretty soon we're flying over what's called a free fire zone, which I don't know if you've heard that expression before, but basically in Vietnam, and I'm assuming other wars, they'd have places where if somebody shot at you, there's supposed to be no good guys down there. And if somebody shoots at you there, you shoot back, right? Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to ask permission. And this may sound odd, but there was places in Vietnam where you're flying over the jungle and you get shot at. It wasn't a free fire zone. You had to call Saigon, which could be, 40, 50 miles away or more. And you talk to some guy there saying, we're getting fired at. My door gunner's getting fired at. We're getting fired at here. Can we fire back?
Yeah.
And then they go, what's your location? Then you give the location. And we're moving in a helicopter, right? What's your location? Now, hang on. Let me get back to you. I got to check. Hang on. And 3, 4, 5 minutes later, they go, 5 minutes later. Yeah, you can fire back. Well, I say, I'm sorry. We're already on the ground. I'm sorry. Too late. Right, anyway, that's the non-free fire zone. All right, so the free fire zone, if you see troops down there, whether they fire or not, if you see troops, you can fire them, right? Because nobody's supposed to be there. So friendly, just the people living on the boonies, but they know that, it's a free fire zone. Be careful. So we're flying over this little hamlet. It's smaller than a village. It's hamlet, yeah. I guess what I call it. It's maybe 80 people living there, families. And marching down this dirt road is a group of about 30 plus. And it's got a guy in the front in black. And all these people are dressed in black. And, everybody, the Viet Cong, they're all wearing black. Well, they did, but so there's a lot of civilians, right? So all these black figures marching in formation down the road, which should have been a clue to the pilot that the army's marching down the road in formation. Anyway, so, and they got stuff on their shoulders. And honestly, it looked like weapons on their shoulders. It looked like they're carrying weapons, right? Because they got stuff on their shoulders. And so this new guy from Germany goes, Mac, get on your gun. Take him out. This VC down there, Viet Cong. But I've already seen this in my mind. I already felt this. I already knew this. This isn't right. And I said, no. No, I'm refusing an order in combat. No, sir. I said, sir. No, sir. It's not what you think. And he goes, damn it, McDonald. He says, I'm giving you a direct order. Fire him. And I refused again, right? And he says, okay, you're going to be court-martialed when I get back. I'm going to have you in prison. This is it. You can't disobey an order in combat. So he turns the helicopter around the other direction, and he tells my door gunner on the other side, I don't remember his name, but he flew with me off and on for about 6 months. And he tells him, he says, fire. And here's the guy that had the guts, because he doesn't see and know things like I do, right? But he goes, since I've been flying McDonald long enough that if he says, whatever he says, if he says it's not right, don't fire, something's wrong, I believe him. I'm not firing. And so now this guy goes crazy, right? This major goes crazy. And he's going, you guys are committing mutiny on me. I'm going to have you guys before a firing squad or life in jail at Fort Leavenworth. And that was a serious threat. And that's exactly what would have happened, right? And so I'm sitting over here, you got to visualize me thinking in my head, I hope I'm right because I'm taking somebody out because they trust me, right?
Yeah.
But I knew I was right. I don't know how many people would have made that decision at my age. I was 20 or so. How many people would have made the decision to disobey a direct order when all I had to do is whatever happened would have been on him because he would force me to do it, right? All I had to do is say, I was following orders. Mm-hmm. But a man has to be above that. A man has to answer to a higher source. And you know something's wrong or doesn't feel right. You have to go with that. Mm-hmm. And so I stood by it. I told the officer, I go, hey, look, Major, let's do this. Compromise. You fly down, dive down towards them like we're going to attack them, buzz over them. And if anybody fires at us, I'll open up.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
So he reluctantly said, okay. So we flew down, a couple of them waved at us, looked at it. You know, it was 30-something children from the village with the Catholic priest in a black robe taking them to the community vegetable garden, and all they had was hoes and rakes and shovels on their shoulders. And I'm thinking, Captain, the major's not saying nothing, right? He's cold, not a word coming out of him, right? I can't see his face. I only imagine his face turned white. But think in that instance, how many lives would have been ruined forever, besides killing people and affecting all the people that loved those people, right?
Yep.
And the, both the pilots would have been affected. Both of us gunners would have been affected the rest of our lives. That would have been one of the worst decisions anybody ever could have made. And that was the hardest decision for me to make. I took the most risk. And even though I got all these medals for all these brave things, to be honest with you, that was the bravest thing I ever did, was disobey an order. I mean, because I would still be in jail today. I would still be in Fort Leavenworth. They take no kindness to disobeying an order. So how did I really know that? I tried to explain it. And anyway, so it turns out there's a good part of this. Turns out that major, that was his first couple weeks in Nam, turned out to be one of the best commanding officers, because eventually ended up getting a position of executive officer or something. One of the best guys I've ever seen. When he went there, he introduced him to every crew he went on. He was first name basis, asked them how their family was, girlfriend. I mean, and if they had any ideas or they saw or heard something, he became the best guy in the company. But look how close he came to being an alcoholic, a drug addict, a tortured soul, right?
Yep.
So you just never know. So it was, anyway, so in Nam, I went through an experience where I was shot down during a 3-week period. I was shot down 3 times. I was wounded once. I was nominated for a Silver Star, got a Distinguished Flying Cross, got a Purple Heart, got a couple air medals that week. During that 3-week period, that my CO brought me in and said, Mac, you need a break. I said, oh, I'm good. He said, no, I'm going to let you, because he told me everything. So here's what you've done, man. You've lost all these helicopters, you know, and all this stuff has happened. He says, no, you need a break. Go anywhere in the country that you want to go. Come back when you're rested, you know, a week or two, whatever. Really? He says, yeah, I got a flight going up here to Nha Trang, which was a beautiful little seaport along the South China Sea. It was a beautiful place. I first arrived in Vietnam, and I ended up there for a few days, and I swore, geez, I wanted to come back. There was a beautiful place, and I didn't get a chance to see it. It had this beautiful Buddhist temple on a hill. It was just beautiful. So I took off, and I flew there. And got let off, and I went on vacation in Vietnam during the war. Took no weapon, not a knife. I took a camera, change of clothes, and when I got to Nha Trang, they had a base with concertina wire around it, and watchtowers, and guards, and safety, and all that stuff. I didn't stay there. I landed there, and I walked off the base into the town, Nha Trang, and I walked umpteen miles away, and I found a place to rent, Vietnamese place, and rented a room, and told the lady when I was renting, I says, I don't want any visitors. Don't send me any special women, ladies. I said, I just needed a rest. And it was beautiful because you had a window. It was up in the second story. It had a window, and you could look out at the ocean one end, one direction. If you looked out, you could see the beautiful waves coming in. South China Sea, beautiful place. And then on this hill, I could see that Buddhist temple. It was so big that the statue of Buddha is the roof, and people go underneath it. It was huge. You could fly a helicopter around it. So I'm watching it, but I'm all uptight. If you could imagine surviving 3 weeks, seeing people get killed, blown up, yourself blown up, shot up, all the stuff that's happened, heavy stuff, right? And now you stop and you're just resting. But I couldn't rest. I was like wound up, you know. It's hard to imagine, but you get wound up. It's like, it's like, and I really, really needed to rest. I needed really to sleep. That's all I really wanted to do. And then there came a knocking at my door in the hotel, motel, whatever it was. And this beautiful, she looked part French, part Vietnamese. She wasn't like, she had that Asian look with Caucasian look together. And she was young and her skin was, it was almost like ivory, mm-hmm. like porcelain, right? It was glowing. She looked young and she was wearing a pair of short pants and a tank top and she had long black hair and she just walks in. And I said, look, I don't want anything you're selling. I don't want anything. Get out of my room. Leave. And I just laid on my bed on my back and I thought she was leaving, you know, because I heard the door shut. And then all of a sudden I feel her hands on my back and my neck and back of my head. And she's giving me probably the most relaxing massage I ever had in my life. I mean, it was like all the tightness of my body was totally relaxing. I was feeling really good. I was feeling blissful, peaceful. It was just really great, right? And I thought, well, do I really want to send her away? And I started getting thoughts, right? You know, young guy, right? I started getting thoughts. As soon as I had a thought like that, all of a sudden, there's nothing, right? And I turn around, there's nobody there. And so the door's locked. There's nobody in the room. And I go, well, who's been massaging my back and relaxing me? So I open up the door, and there's nobody in the hallway. I go down in the hallway. There's an old guy sitting on the floor of the steps. And I tell him, who's this girl? And he says, nobody's come this way. Nobody's gone in your room. Nobody's left your room. I said, that's impossible. Somebody was in my room. And the landlord lady says, I didn't send you anybody. So I went back there, closed the door, and had the greatest 17 hours of sleep I ever had in my life. It was wonderful. But you got to ask yourself, who gave me the massage? Was I totally so whacked out that I imagined the whole thing? What was it? So in Vietnam, I had things happen all the time. And as I told you a few stories from some others, there's a lot of people had one thing happen. And a lot of people shared like one thing happens with me experiences. So, you asked about Vietnam and all the strange stuff that goes on there. What I interviewed once upon a time, I was talking to this guy. He was a former POW. One of the few that ever escaped, but he escaped from South Vietnam. He was at a camp inside South Vietnam, which was not like getting out of North. And, but he talked about his mother praying for him and doing all this stuff. And I don't remember the full story, but basically there was a sequence between him and his mother when she was praying for him and things happening for him in the prison and how he eventually got out and everything and how he was a prisoner for a while, and I'm not exactly sure how he escaped or how that happened. But he basically said his mother saved him. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, I should have pushed for more details, but it was like the guy's looking at me glassy-eyed saying, no, my mother saved me. I said, okay, great. And I found out that she nonstop prayed for him every day, went to church, did these things and everything. But he believed his mother was there helping him to get him through when he was hungry, when he was hurting and everything else. So the world that I live in is not just about neat things happening. It's also about spiritual things happening and finding moments of bliss and finding moments of joy. And if people are spending their whole life just looking for the supernatural, if they're not looking for the divine source of that supernatural, then I think they're missing a big, huge gap and they're missing the point. Because even bad, awful, ugly, demonic things can happen with powerful people. Doesn't make them spiritual. Mm-hmm. So seeking powers and abilities is not what you should be doing. You should be seeking love and sharing with others. And if you're not doing that, then you got to examine why you're here. What's your purpose?
After Vietnam, in a sort of nutshell, what happened next to you?
Well, what happened was there was a couple of things. One funny story, but yeah. one of those chicken soup of the soul kind of moments. I had been dating my wife, who's my wife now. We've been married over 50 years. But we met in 1960. We were both 14, and then we were in a class together in my senior year. We we were going steady. I don't know if you did in England, but you got steady with somebody. That was your girl, right? That was your guy, right? So, and then I knew, because I had a dream when I had that near-death experience when I was a child, I knew she was going to be my future wife. But I also knew that I had things I had to do. Like, I had to go to Hawaii, and I met this Kahuna priest guy there and studied. And then I had to go to Europe, and I bummed around Europe, met some really interesting people, had some neat things happen, supernatural. But I also knew that she had to go off to college. She was going to Berkeley, University of California. And I had to do all these other things I had to do. They were destined. And when I came back and got out of the Army, it was 8 years since we had a relationship, And it was like, you're back? Who cares? I got a life, I said, no, you're going to marry me. I know it. So I think I asked her to marry me like 10 times, and she said, no, don't ask again. So when she said that, what did I do? I went out and bought a ring. I felt confident. So I had a ring in my pocket I carried. I said, the time is going to come when the energy and the situation is perfect. She won't be able to say no, and I'll ask her. Now, either I was the world's greatest stalker, as they would label you now. Oh, he's a stalker, man. Let me tell you about this guy. He didn't take no for an answer. But I went to visit her, and she had this girl that she worked with at Macy's department store. They were both in management. And they had this apartment in San Francisco on Twin Peaks, I think it was. And it overlooked the city with the lights. It was a beautiful place. I mean, it's like, great job, great apartment. And I went there I was going to go visit them during Christmas time. It was the 10th of December, 1969, about 8 o'clock at night, in my mind. And all day long, they were sitting there trying to put these lights on this Christmas tree and get them to work. Now, in the 1960s, the lights used to be, if you had 100 bulbs, 800 bulbs, didn't matter. If you had one bulb on that string out.
Yep. You had to work out which it was. Yep.
Yeah. She had 800 bulbs on this thing. And they've been working on it all day. They couldn't find a bulb that was bad. I mean, they put one in, take one out, put it in, put it out, twist it, do all this stuff. And they're telling me that story. And I walk in and I'm looking at the Christmas tree and I'm looking at all the bulbs. And I'm very confident looking them both in the eye. And I'm not looking at the tree anymore. And I just reach back behind me and I said, now, I'm going to fix it for you right now. I know I can fix it. And then just kind of give me that smile like, yeah, we've been in all day, right? I reach back and I grab one bulb at random, if there's such a thing, one bulb at random, and I twist it. And 800 lights come on. I can see the lights shining in their eyes, right? And I'm going. So I got down to my knee, pulled the ring out. I said, it ain't going to get any better than this. This is the perfect time, right? So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. And we got engaged December 10th. And anyway, so she heard all kinds of stories about me going through high school. And she heard I was psychic. I mean, I'd be watching a ball game and I'd tell everybody, next pitch is a home run. Or this round, the guy gets knocked out, in a boxing match on TV. Yeah. Whatever it was, I could just, and people would always, oh, that's really cool. Nice trick, right? And so I try to tell her, these things are real. And it's like, yeah. If I see it, I'll believe it, right? So one night, it's a hot day in Danville, California. It's a little valley. And we had renting a condo, and it was two stories. And upstairs, well, you're in England, you don't know what a hot day is. But in the rest of the world, in the rest of the world, when it's 110 degrees, it's hotter upstairs, because the air conditioner works upstairs. And all the heat rises. But I go up there, but my wife goes, so it's too hot for me. I'm going downstairs, and I'm sleeping on the couch. So I'm laying there in my bed, and I'm looking at a picture of Paramahansa Yogananda on my nightstand. I'm just focusing on him. And all of a sudden, boom, it's one of your typical, it's just a typical astral travel out of body experience. So it's at that point, okay, I'm out of my body. Great. I got a cord attached to my body. Great. I'm floating the ceiling. No big deal. I float down the stairs. No big deal. I'm floating across the room towards her. No big deal. Until she sits up and sees me in this astral body floating towards her. And I said, and so my mind registered, well, that's different. That's not something you see every day. And no, normally nobody ever sees you in an astral body when you travel, right? You tell people that you're crazy. Yeah, you were traveling. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody sees you, right? So she's seeing me and her eyes are getting big, right? So I sit on the sofa and she's sitting there staring at me. And I look at her and as I'm talking to her, the sofa raises and floats about a foot and a half, about 18 inches, off the floor, the carpet floor. And it's hovering. It's moving around. And of course, she gets scared. And I said, whatever you need me, I'll be there. Not when you want me, but when you need me, I'll be there. And then, boom, because she got so scared, it just destroyed the energy of me. I ended up falling on my body, about 200 pounds, you know, just boom, there you are. And so the next day she wakes up and she goes, I had this terrible nightmare last night. I said, no, it wasn't. Let me tell you what it was. So I told her the whole experience, right? And she goes, don't you ever do that to me and stay out of my dreams. I said, okay, it wasn't a dream. So anyway, so I was having things like this happen all the time, all the time. And so I was working for the Postal Service. Things would happen. I'd worked for a scuba diving place. All these things would always come into play. And I would always know things. I'd have dreams about, I dreamt about this aircraft crashing in Chicago, killing all these people and everything. And ahead of time, then I watched the news, and then it happens. And so I kept having all these premonitions about stuff that I could not control. You know, people getting killed or shot or crashed. And I kept thinking, well, what good is it to have these abilities if you can't do anything with them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you know it's going to crash, you call up the airlines. They think, you know, let's send an FBI to this guy. You can't support the airlines and say, hey, I have this feeling the airplane is going to crash. You know, you just don't do that. So one day I was bemoaning the fact that I kind of wish I don't have these abilities. I mean, it's frustrating to have them and not being able to do anything about it. And next day I woke up and I felt blind. I felt deaf. I felt like I couldn't taste nothing. Something was different. I realized that I spent my whole life making every single decision in my life based on my intuition, based on a knowing, even picking out what I'm going to eat or everything. Every decision I ever made was based on using my intuition. Obviously, I don't have any intellect. I don't use that. It's all intuition, right? And it went 2 weeks and I was going through hell. And I said, oh my God, this is what it's like for people that don't know what's going to be. They can't remember tomorrow, right? You can't remember tomorrow. So so it was a big fight. And I decided that I better sit down and pray. I want it back, please. Mercy, you know, divine grace, something. And when it came back, and I felt so relieved. I never complained about it again, but it taught me something.
Good day, gentlefolk. I doth have breaking news. Your Weird Tales host, Charles Christian, has written a new book called Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England. 5 shocking true tales that are stranger than fiction. There's murder, mayhem, treason, incest, adultery, and worse. Read about the real antics of 9 saints. Yes, saints. 8 kings and 5 queens of England. Plus the wickedest of all stepmothers. And be amazed, or horrified, or appalled, or all three. If you love weird history, and methinks you do, hop over to Amazon for your copy of Charles Christian's Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England. Grab yours now.
Because I always tell people, oh, get over with it, man. It's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. You know what? These people don't know that's a fact. They don't know what's going to happen an hour from now, let alone 10 years from now or tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I was just telling people, hey, come on. And I realized that people are living their lives having to make decisions based only on their own personal intelligence and best guess. My God, how terrible. So it was like me losing my vision or something. It was like a part of me. And I am grateful I got it, but I was also grateful it happened because I have some compassion now. Because I just took it for granted. Everybody kind of had some level of that. But I realized that every decision I made in my life is based on that. And that means if I want to friend somebody on Facebook, if I want to do an interview with you, it's all based on yes or no. It's just, I just go by it. Mm-hmm. I give talks around the world. I give workshops. I give 8-hour workshops. I'm asked to give a talk. I give a talk. People always ask me, what are you going to talk about? And I always tell them, I said, don't know what I know. Because I never prepare a talk. I never take notes and go in there and I got little cards. I never use an overhead, clicking on a screen, on a PowerPoint. I just, whatever comes to my heart, there's no filter. I just let it flow. And sometimes I say some things to some people and it's like, why? A normal person would say, why? And then I find out later on, some really interesting has happened. But it was like, I did an interview on a radio show in Chicago, a lovely lady named Holly. And we were doing a bunch of stuff and everything. And we finished the interview and she's in a parking lot talking to me on her cell phone. She's trying to get out of there. She's trying to go. And I keep talking to her. She says, you're delaying me. You already delayed me 5 minutes. I said, well, wait another minute. And she goes, what? I got to go. So I kept talking to her. And finally I said, okay, you can go. So she goes out there. And about 20 minutes later, I get this call back. She goes, Reverend Bill, if I'd left when I was going to leave, I'd been in the middle of this huge crash on the Chicago Loop, the freeway. They were all piled up. I was just I was literally out of the loop. I was behind all this stuff, right? She says, thank you. So it was like, I delayed her, but I wasn't sure why.
Yeah.
And then her mother, I became good friends with her mother, Jean, beautiful lady. I call her St. Jean, beautiful lady. But I was talking to her one day because she was bemoaning that, because I told her that you got a blessed life. God is looking after you. God is looking after you. Don't worry. I mean, he's looking after you. You're blessed, right? So she calls me back the next day. Oh, yeah, so much for your blessings. God's looking after me. We had a windstorm through here last night, and this big oak tree or some kind of big tree, it fell, just missed the car, just missed the house. It landed between the two houses. What kind of luck is that? And I looked at it and said, it missed the car? It missed the house. Oh, okay. You're right. So, yeah. So what part of that? So sometimes I tell people things and I tell them a story. I don't know why particular story I tell them, but when I tell them a story, and then it'll dawn on them why. They'll go, how'd you know that? How'd you know I was having a problem with this or that? So I can answer some people's questions indirectly by just opening my mind up and letting it happen, just letting it flow. And it serves me. And as long as I continue to live what I call a moral life, and try to be honest with people. You try to be honest. Sometimes you say things and you believe that's a fact. You find out later that maybe you had faith in somebody and it wasn't deserved and you recommend somebody for a job or a teacher or something. So I'm not infallible because I like to find the best in people. And I have a motto. It's all about love and service. People ask, what's my mission in life? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? And I tell them, first off, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, do it for the divine. Make whatever you're doing a love and a service and give. And if you do that, that is your purpose. And so people, what do you mean? I'm just a school teacher. Beautiful. You work with these kids. Well, I'm a custodian. Beautiful. Somebody's got to be a custodian. Do a good job, right? Every job is noble. And I get in trouble with graduations and stuff because I listen to these graduation speakers. I don't know about in England, but in America, all these graduation speakers, especially celebrities, go, all you college graduates, when you go out there, find out what you love to do. And make that your job, and you go live where you love to live and then go find a person that truly is your soulmate and love that, and I'm going, what? And then they go, and you can be anything you want to be. They're telling some people that they can't be everything they want to be. You know, there's people out there that got various handicaps, whether it's mental, emotional, spiritual, or physical. They got handicaps. They got karma. They can't, you know, you can't tell a guy with an 80 IQ that he could be a technician, you know, writing programs, right? So, I mean, that's, or a guy that's 5'2" and he's 300 pounds and he wants to be an NBA basketball player. He can't be that. He can't be whatever he wants to be. Hmm. All right, so my talk is usually short and people sit there and look at me kind of going, what? So I tell people, it doesn't matter what you do for a living. Okay? All work is noble. But whatever you're doing, love it. Love it. I don't care if you're bartending. I don't care if you're taxi driver, Uber driver. I don't care if you're sweeping the floors. I don't care if you're president of the company. All work is noble. Whatever you're doing, love it. Do it for the divine. If you're always working for God, how can you go wrong? Love it. And wherever you live, love it. You know? If you get a, oh, I hate this apartment, I hate this name. Love it. Enjoy where you're at. Enjoy the job you have. And whoever you're with, love them. Because if you can't love the person you're with, if you can't love where you live, and you can't love what you do, whatever you do after that, you can't love it as well. It continues. You got to learn to love what you're doing now. And then for you to take the next step. And so, as far as doing what you can do, you got to be a little bit realistic. You can visualize, you can materialize, you can do all these great things, right? You can put a picture on a refrigerator of a new Jaguar car, right? You know, you can fish. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna get this car. I'm gonna get this job. Well, if you're not studying for the job, and if you don't save up your money to buy the car, I'm sorry, that's a lot of dreaming.
Yeah.
Don't spend all your life dreaming. Do. So if you want a better job, yeah, visualize it, think positive, great. But then do everything you got to do to get that better job, like learn how to learn whatever computer programs you need to know, whatever training you need, get everything ready so when it comes, you're ready for it, right? So that's my message for graduates, and it's not well received because they don't want to do what they love to do. And I said, what do you love to do? Oh, I love music and poetry and walking in the rain and mint juleps. And I like to do a blog, fashion blog. That's what you love to do. Good luck. Make a living with that, right? So I want to be an influencer on YouTube. Come on. I mean, so obviously there's somebody that's done it. So somebody's making money. But I tell you what, you can't just go out there and find something I love to do because nobody's going to pay me to meditate all day and read good books, right? So it's But everything I do, I love to do, if that makes sense.
It does, yes.
And so you got to put your heart into these things. You got to just take a step at a time. Now, when I was in England, I was in England and Wales in 2016. I arrived there with practically no money. I was going to do some talks at some various places. Nothing was finalized. It was all kind of loose, right? I took off on a venture. I left my house, told my wife, I'm going to be gone 55 days. And in those days I'm gone, I'm taking $80 of cash. She goes, what? You're going to be gone 55? I said, yeah. And I had nothing laid out. There was no, but I went to Florida and I gave a bunch of talks. Somebody had me at a library. Somebody had me at a couple of people's different houses. At a corporate meeting, I talked to a bunch of groups and stuff. And next thing you know, people were donating money, you know, for me to go, you know, my trip to England, further it on, right? I get to England. People were kind enough to find me, you know, accommodations and meals and take care of me. And great kindnesses were extended to me. And I met some really beautiful, neat people. Jeff Thompson. I don't know if you know him. He's a 4 or 5-time BAFTA winner. Read a bunch of books and stuff. Real nice man. Used to be in the martial arts and everything. Great friendship with him. And I met Anthony Summers, another guy. He's an author, and he was a former martial arts guy. And he has a group he works out at the Red Corner Gym in England there. And I met some just unique, unique people. But I was also, while I was there, I picked up, I got pink eye, I got 2 ear infections, I got strep throat. I had double pneumonia, both lungs, and I had ear infections. So, and I was totally run down because I was just, but it didn't stop me. I was functioning. And then when I got landed in Florida, I had blood coming out of my nose and ears and everything. And I went to the hospital and I was pretty serious. So I was supposed to, all these astrologers, everybody thought, oh, don't let them operate on you tomorrow. It's your death day, which is always a great bedside manner to tell somebody. I mean, imagine you're in the hospital and you get this call from somebody. It's an astrologer. I just did your charts. It's the worst day. Don't let them touch your heart. I'm sorry. It's 8 hours from now. I'm going to do it. I'm okay. But things happen to you in life. I took that whole thing because I knew I'd survive. I knew this trip needed to happen. I needed to meet these wonderful people who have been integral part of my learning experience and spiritual experience. These people all added little layers. Mm-hmm. I had my portrait taken when I was really sick, just the day before I left or 2 days before I left to London. A guy named Richard Nunn, N-U-N-N, I think is his name. He's a young photographer. He does this beautiful stuff. But he sends me a text message. I don't know how he found me or how he got to me, who he sent it to and got to me. Somehow this message gets to me that you want to do my portrait. So I'm thinking, I ain't got time to sit around for a guy to paint a portrait of me, right? I'm thinking portrait, right? So he says, oh, no, I'm going to take your picture. And I said, okay, well, I'm on my way back. Well, before I go to the airport, I'll stop. Nicest man, but he took this picture of me, which I'll have to share with you sometime. And he captures this. It's almost color, but it's almost black and white. It doesn't have lots of color. It's kind of shades. And it's got me with a black hat on and my gray beard. But I have this look of somebody, I mean, I'm just like a couple of days before I'm supposed to die kind of look, right? Mm-hmm. And in truth, I was, right? But he captures this uniqueness in the picture. He was doing a book. I don't know if he finished it, but he was doing a book called Spiritual Warriors or Spiritual Teachers of the World or something like that. But that basically it was just pick these spiritual kind of people from all walks of the spectrum. And he was capturing me. He was going to make some kind of a coffee table book. But he gave me the photo to use online anywhere I want. So I have this belief when I travel and when I go places, I have this belief that everything will be taken care of. Everything will happen as it's supposed to happen. Because people will look at my life and they'll see, if you read my autobiography, which is, Warrior, Spiritual Odyssey. I got a bunch of books out there, but that's my autobiography. It's Warrior, a Spiritual Odyssey. And in there, people read it. They said, oh man, you had this happen and that happened and all these terrible things. And you were sick and things and blah, blah, blah. And I, you know what? I said, I have no complaints. I'm not a victim. Everything happened to me, gave me a gift. I've learned such beautiful lessons from everything and from every person that did me wrong or hurt me or betrayed me. It all taught me something about love and compassion and mostly about forgiveness. And forgiveness is the key element that separates the average person from the spiritual giants of the world. Think about Mahatma Gandhi. Think about St. Francis of Assisi. Think about anybody, Martin Luther King, all the stuff that happened to these people, the authorities and everybody. Mandel, down there in South Africa, thrown in jail for all these years. He came out and he forgave everybody, right? Don't punish anybody. Don't, you know, just get the truth out and bury it. That's it, right? Own up. Mm-hmm. That's the end of it. And then Martin Luther King, he was beaten by police and jailed and of course they ended up being assassinated. But then and all these people have gone through trials in their life, and every one of them goes, love your enemy. They all end up reflecting on Jesus' words, love thy enemy, love thy neighbor as yourself, right? So when you go through life, if you see everybody as yourself, if you see God in all, including yourself, you see God in everybody, and you believe that we're all one, part of the same energy, the same dream, how could you really hate anybody? You know, you got to love them all. Now, you don't have to like them all because there's people out there doing your thing. You don't have to like them all or spend time with them, but you got to love them, right? You don't hate anybody. So that's how I go through life. I set my sails, and the wind is the breath of love. And you sail with it. You go with it.
And that's it. We're almost out of time. We'll have the final part of our interview with the Reverend Bill next week. However, let's just squeeze in one final story. A story which illustrates that the fickle finger of fate can strike us down at any moment. Let's talk about meteorites. They hit our planet on a regular basis. Check out NASA's Fireball database if you don't believe me. And you probably never want to step outside your house again. But in fact, they actually cause relatively few injuries to people and even fewer deaths because there are so many empty places and even more emptier oceans where they can crash without causing any harm. For example, the giant Tunguska explosion over Siberia in 1908 is thought to have killed just two people. I say thought, those are unconfirmed reports. And there's a 17th century Italian manuscript which talks about a monk being killed by a stone that came out of the sky in 1677. Again, rather hazy. And that's it. Not many deaths at all, unlike movies. However, recently researchers in Turkey, going through the state archives of the old Ottoman Empire, found a report stating that in 1888, a fireball or space rock struck a hill near what is now the city of Salimaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan and killed one man and paralysed another, giving us our first officially recorded death by meteorite report. Now that really is unlucky. And that really is it. Now it just remains for me to say this is Charles Christian saying until the next time we're together, stay well, stay weird, stay different, and keep watching the skies for meteorites.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com, by email to weirdtales@icloud.com, and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.